The Guardian.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Was gathering up on Gela Bridge, and that was about an hour after prayer, around about that time. Then there was a lot of tear gas for over an hour, and the people were resisting and
With little warning, army vehicles and soldiers moved into Tahrir Square. They chased people well out of the area and into nearby streets.
This morning, we drove back into the centre of Suez to survey the destruction. Yesterday, these burned-out carcasses were full of riot police. Now, they have all fled.
Cairo is like a war zone. As violence broke out across the Egyptian capital, this popular Arab uprising is becoming increasingly violent and is taking over more and more of this troubled region.
Amateur film showing what appears to be a body being carried away. Syrian opposition activists say it was taken in Homs and that at least 13 people were killed there on Sunday. President Bashar al-Assad is continuing to ignore pleas from the international community to stop the violent crackdown, which, it's claimed, has cost at least 60 lives over the weekend.
Can it really be a year since the start of the Arab Spring? Oh yes, it can, as this week's celebrations in Egypt testify. But many parts of the Arab world are still troubled, as one of this week's studio guests, Ian Black, can vouch. He's just back from a tough 10-day stint in Syria, which brought him closer than he might have liked to the hideous ongoing violence in that country. But there's good news too, as our other guest, Samuel Al-Youssef, can demonstrate. He's one of the editors of a new online literary journal, The Arab-Israeli Book Review, which launched this month with the promise to go beyond the news headlines and explore the Middle East through its rich, playful and provocative literature. So Ian, we're going to start in true newspaper style with the sort of serious current affairs-y end of this podcast, and I would like you to talk through some of the books that that have caught your interest in recent months, because obviously there must be quite a rush of literature coming out now.
I've got a great pile of books in front of me on the table here in the studio, and that's only a small part of the books that have been coming out for several months now. But there are different kinds of books. Some of them are by journalists who've been reporting on what's took place over what's been an extraordinary year. Some of them are by academics. Some of them are people who aren't easily categorised. One of the books we've got here is Ahda Suef's book about Cairo. She's the Egyptian-British author. Maybe we'll be talking about that a bit later. But there are different kinds of books. One of the most interesting ones I've got in front of me here is by Marwan Bishara, he's a Palestinian who is the chief political analyst for Al Jazeera, the satellite TV channel that has played a very important galvanizing role, if you like, in this past year of uprisings. And his book's called The Invisible Arab. He makes an interesting case that a lot of the writing about, reporting about the events of the Arab Spring has been through too narrow a Western prism, a slightly condescending view, almost a sort of colonialist one, I think he's saying, suggesting that this has all come out of the blue, that Arabs who've been silent and oppressed for many years have suddenly risen up thanks to Western technology, Facebook and Twitter, and are now reclaiming their freedom. And his argument is, and it's a very compelling one in some detail, that there has been events going on over many decades, Arabs struggling to reclaim their own lives, living almost exclusively in a state of dictatorship of authoritarian societies. And he's slightly picking away at a Western-centred narrative, which had believed, if you like, in a sort of Arab exception, that somehow Arabs or Muslims both were incapable of running their own lives, being Democrats, taking their own fate into their own hands.
There's an interesting thing about this book, one of which is that he makes it very clear that he's very aware in that he had to finish it in December. And there's a slight anxiety about where things will be by the time the book has published. Do you think things have changed since December when he put the final full stop on it?
Well, I don't think anything's changed in the big picture. I think it has been an extraordinary year. This is a story which is still being written. It began in Tunisia and December 2010. We've seen in quick, rapid succession, we saw one, two, three authoritarian regimes toppled, or at least challenged, first Tunisia, then Egypt, then a longer struggle over Libya, which eventually succumbed. But it's an ongoing story. You mentioned that I'd just been in Syria. Well, goodness me, 10 months on, the outcome of the Syrian uprising is impossible to read. It's a titanic struggle, still continuing.
And Marwan is quite depressive in some ways. He says his conclusion is that now there is every likelihood that change will come only through military struggle. Do we think that now?
I think it's you have to be a bit careful about making generalizations because circumstances have been different everywhere. The first of the Arab revolutions in Tunisia was remarkably peaceful. First of all, who imagined that a small North African country known mostly to the outside world for the quality of its beaches would turn out to be the pioneer in leading change across a whole region of the world involving millions of people. There was very little in the way of armed struggle or violence there. In Egypt, proportionate to the size of the population, 85 million people, not very many people were killed, of course. Hundreds were, and one shouldn't belittle that. Libya is a very different story. And Syria, sadly, probably, I would argue, the most significant of these revolutions in terms of its implications for the wider Middle East. The death toll rises by the day. Will it be ended by military intervention? I think it would be a very, very unwise analyst or pundit who would predict that that is the way to resolve the crisis.
Now, let's move on. You talked about the various different sorts of books, and one sort of book is what I would describe as an I Was There book. We mentioned Adaf Swaif, and here she is talking on Women's Hour to Jenny Murray, who asked her how dangerous it was to live in Tahrir Square.
I never felt particularly endangered personally in Tahrir because after the 28th, the danger was always on the periphery, the people who were protecting the square. And there was really no point at all in somebody like me being there because I would only jeopardise other people, the young people. So my concern for safety was really to do with the young people, including, of course, my own niece's nephew, son. And there was the day of the camel battle, for example, the 2nd of February, when they were all in the square doing various things. And one had to face up to the very real possibility that something could happen to any one of them because things were happening to people, you know, everywhere and people that we knew. But concern for my personal safety, I guess that only happens sort of in the airport on the way in and out of the country. Although, no, I
Why?
Actually...
Why? Why would it happen in the airport?
That's where you're actually sort of going through a bottleneck with your sort of name on a document out there in front of a police officer. But I will tell you, actually, that there was one evening when I did an interview, a TV interview, with an Indian television station at home. And after... This was during the 18 days. And after the two journalists came into the apartment, there was a ring at the doorbell, and I opened the door, and there was the daughter of the concierge, and she said, "Who are the people who've just come up?" And I was completely sort of, you know, taken aback. And she sort of saw the look on my hand. She said, "Well, it's your apartment, and you are free to do as you please, but the plainclothes people have been round, and they have questioned everybody, and we have to report to them if people talk to media people or to foreigners. So how long are they staying?" And actually, I left with them and moved actually into my brother's apartment with his family until the 11th of February because I didn't feel secure in my own apartment anymore.
So Ian, Adaf there, does this sort of book have a resonance beyond people who have a direct interest in Egypt?
Adaf, first and foremost, is a well-known novelist. She's well-known in this country. I think her book, which I very much enjoyed, The Map of Love, was on a Booker list. She's quite well known here. I think she's not so well known in the Arab world. As far as I know, she writes fiction only in English, not in Arabic. But what I think she's done here is to encapsulate the experience of one very articulate person with her roots in Egypt and her family there, but the very, very emotional experience of taking part in this revolution. This has not been a story of hard men plotting in small smoke-filled rooms to overthrow a government. This has been a mass movement. We all remember and can still see today the very moving images of many, many hundreds of thousands of people in Tahrir Square and elsewhere in Egypt doing what seemed to be impossible. They overthrew the pharaoh, to use that obvious image, but a powerful image from Egyptian culture. They did something amazing. And I think that she gives very powerful expression to the emotional dimension of the story.
Now, this new internet age has given us a new form of publishing of journalism, and we at The Guardian are getting into it. We've got a book, in fact, of all our reporting coming up in the next couple of weeks, haven't we?
There's going to be a Guardian book called The Arab Spring, Rebellion, Revolution and a New World Order. And that's a large part of that coming out next month in February is going to be edited, very heavily edited extracts of our much-admired live blog, a rolling online coverage of the Arab uprisings of the last year. It began, of course, and attracted huge interest in our coverage of the Egyptian revolution, but we've continued and it carries on every day. So part of the book will be a compression of that enormous quantity of material, plus selected articles, plus an introduction which I have written to try to set the stage for the way The Guardian has been covering this amazing year, which, of course, is now well into its second year.
Mm-hmm. Would you say academics, or do we have ex-diplomats? What is the work, the really definitive work that you would reference?
My favourite book, I have to give a plug for it, is called Karama, Journeys Through the Arab Spring by Johnny West, who was a Reuters journalist for a long time, worked in the Middle East, and he's written, I think, a lovely account of the revolutions in Libya, Tunisia and Egypt. Been out for several months already, and I think it's a very elegantly written and illuminating book. That's one of this genre of journalists writing about what's gone on.
That's out from Heron Books, and it is worth pointing out that some of these books are not published by very familiar publishers, which may make them quite difficult to get hold of. But
I think we'll see a lot more of them. There have been several on Egypt, for example. Ashraf Khalil, who writes for the Times newspaper, has just produced a book about Egypt. One to watch is coming up by Wael Ghanem, who people will remember as the Google executive in Egypt, who attracted enormous publicity when he broke down and wept in sheer exasperation and horror at what was going on at the high point of the revolution, and became a sort of cult figure, an embodiment of young people and the sacrifices they were making. There are some academic books. There's a good one about Egypt by Stephen Cook. There is a book about Syria, which is always a difficult country to understand. It's impenetrable and complicated. There are books in French. There's an excellent one called The Arab Revolution, translated here by Jean-Pierre Filliou, a French expert on the Arab world.
There's also quite a conservative movement, isn't there? I spotted one by John R. Bradley, who I think writes for the Mail on Sunday, and it's called After the Arab Spring, How Islamists Hijacked the Middle East Revolts. There's quite a body of this sort of stuff.
There is a subcategory of books which are extremely critical, which don't share the general enthusiasm for what's gone on. The one that you've mentioned talks about an Islamist takeover of the Arab revolutions, which is a hugely overstated argument, and one which, in my view, and I think many people would agree, misrepresent the nature of what is happening. Islamists are going to be very different if they're competing in open democratic systems. There's one here I haven't read, but it's called Arab Spring, Libyan Winter. The title speaks for itself. And here's one which is called The Devil We Don't Know, The Dark Side of Revolutions in the Middle East. And that's also about the dangers of an Islamist takeover. So that's a category, fairly distinct one, that is very, very negative about the phenomenon.
I've got Sami here, as I said at the beginning, who's been nodding enthusiastically and respectfully. And Sami, you did mention one non-fiction title when I got in touch with you, and I'm very interested in this because it raises a whole other side of reporting the Arab experience. Tell us about it.
Yes, it was a surprising, actually, book. It's written by the Lebanese author and journalist, well-known author and journalist in Lebanon called Hazem Saghia, and it's called Muzakirat Randa Trans, the memoirs of Randa the Trans. transsexual. And it is a story, actually, about an Algerian, a Muslim Algerian, you know, is transsexual and wants to become a woman. Never written like this before. I've never seen anything like this before. I've been reviewing books for more than 20 years now. It is quite brave. It is both of them, the author and the protagonist of this book, both of them are so brave to put the story out there with everything that's been happening. It's not a story of some freakish creature. It's really about a case for somebody who's telling us how it feels to be herself, you know, somebody who was born into a society like the Muslim Algerian society, where just simply the distinction between male and female gender is just a natural, divine thing, unquestionable in any way. There's no way that you can think differently. It's amazing because Hazem Saghir is one of those people who believe that in order, actually, we're talking about democracy in the Arab world. He believes that in order actually to have democracy, we must believe in the right of individuals and the voice of the individuals, that everybody can talk for themselves, because we do have this problem. And I think, you know, you pointed out to some of these problems and now with this Arab revolution, that quite often people tend to identify themselves within their confession, their own sect, their own religion, while what we want are free citizens. If we want to have democracy, how can you have democracy without sort of, you know, free citizens and free citizenships, when people can only identify themselves in terms of the clan or the family or the sect they belong to? So in this sense, this book, you know, though nonfiction, it's an attempt to sort of, you know, promote the issue of individualism in the Arab world.
One of the aspects of the Egyptian revolution that have attracted quite a lot of attention, of course, has been the question of women. Women are notoriously harassed and ill-treated in public spaces. Yeah. In Egypt. We've seen this awful business of the so-called virginity tests. Yeah. Conducted by male members of the security forces on women, the abuse, the rape of women taking part in the revolution. And a sense, I think, for Egyptian women that... If the revolution is going to achieve all its goals, it must involve a real emancipation for them. Now, in a fundamentally conservative and Muslim society, where the politics of the Egyptian revolution have brought those conservative forces to the fore, that's a really tall order. So I think issues of personal morality, sexuality, and so on and so forth are going to be sorely tried and tested. Yes. In these new sort of circumstances.
Samia, in your editorial in the first issue of the Arab Israeli Book Review, you raised the interesting point about what it is proper to talk about and how one deals with humour, how one all these sort of slightly subversive ways of talking culturally and politically.
Yes. Well, we talked about this book about non-fiction. There's another book I want to talk about, which is Taxi, and it's part of what I'm talking about here, is that how to connect to the language of the people. We do have a problem within Arabic literature, within Arabic fiction. For a long time, that, you know, our authors been too elitist, too formalist, more interested in the avant-garde literature. You know, they just read Faulkner and they want just to write like Faulkner, for example. But recently there's been attempts to sort of reconnect with people, and a book like Taxi by Khaled Al-Khamisi, for example, this is a book that sort of, you know, about what taxi drivers say, how they express themselves, how they protest, and you know, taxi drivers are very good at nagging and grumbling all the time. And if you are an Egyptian, they have this sense of humor, which is wonderful as well. We have this high politics, which is mostly tired against another, attacks and accusations, and then we have this sort of very elitist form of literature that nobody understands anyway. So it's in between, we have all these voices, all these narratives, which are not being represented. What we're trying to do in our blog is actually to bring in all these sort of diverse voices from somebody like Khaled Al-Khamisi to Israeli writer not Arab Israeli writer like Said Kashua, for example, who is also another voice, somebody who writes in Hebrew and tell us jokes, Arabic jokes in Hebrew. So this is the kind of sort of narrative that we would like to sort of see.
Is Taxi fiction or non-fiction?
That's a good question.
We can't tell.
But he does say that it is fictionalized or fictitious characters. Well, it's very easy that you could say that. But then when you read it, it's like you feel that he was just sitting there in the back seat writing down what the taxi driver was telling him every time he got into a taxi. So it doesn't really matter, to be honest.
We're now going to leave this discussion here. We're now stuck at the crossroads between non-fiction and fiction.
Welcome Egyptians head to Cairo's Tahrir Square on Wednesday to mark the first anniversary of the uprising that toppled former President Hosni Mubarak. Many here are seeking a new wave of demonstrations, this time in protest at the military ruler's perceived foot-dragging when it comes to handing over power to a civilian government. 1 year on since the uprising began.
So let's now turn properly to fiction. And joining us is the translator, Peter Clark. Welcome, Peter.
Good afternoon. Good to be with you.
Now, you wrote a piece for the Literary Review in which you talk about a literature of Arab consciousness written in many languages.
Arabic is not the only medium in which Arabs are writing, in both poetry and in fiction. Some writers are very well known in writing in other languages, like Ahdaf Suwaif or Hisham Matar, both of whom have been shortlisted for the Booker Prize. They write in English, Ahdaf, Egyptian, Hisham, Libyan. But there has been a long tradition of North Africans writing in French, becoming part of the French literary scene, like Taha Ben Junoul from Morocco and others from Algeria and Tunisia. But also with an Arab diaspora over the last generation, they're writing in all languages of Europe, German, Dutch, French, and so on.
And are these translated then from Dutch and French into English?
They are travelling. For example, Rafik Shermi, who's Syrian, has written several novels of what we might call Syrian Arab consciousness. And he's been based in Germany for a long time, writes in German, and they have been translated into English by Anthea Bell, who's the leading translator of German contemporary German literature into English.
Now, you also talk about the huge variety of forms and themes. You say there it's social realism, magical realism, fantasy, a noticeable absence of ideology. I want to bring Samir in about that. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with this, Samir?
There is certain diversity, but as I said before, we still have this problem of literature being really far away from the readership. And I think Peter might tell us even more because he's been involved in the IPA and other initiatives.
The IPF is the Arab Booker,
yes,
it's known as.
Yes. I mean, I think there's still a problem of readership in the Arab world. This diversity does not solve the problem.
Last week, or the week before, we carried a piece by Khaled Hroub.
Khaled Hroub, yes.
On the IPAF, which is the Arabic Booker. Yeah. And he made the interesting point that a lot of the issues that have now come up politically are prefigured in the novels that have been written over the last few years, but a lot of them are still in Arabic, haven't been translated, so we perhaps didn't see it.
I realised that actually what was being written now is actually what's been written for the last 30 years, in a sense. No, it's not. I don't mean that they're just repeating themselves, but the themes, I mean, exile, the disappointment of life, the despair from any prospect of work, all these issues, like, you know, sectarianism in a country like Lebanon, the rise of the Islamic fundamentalism in Tunisia. These are the topic and the themes in the short list of Booker Prize.
Nevertheless, Peter, you think you have seen a new generation emerging?
Yes. So I think there has been a greater variety of writing in more recent years, and some of the very best books of the last 20 years have, I think, prefigured this. I think of a book like the novel by Ahlam al-Mustaghanami, Memory of the Flesh, which challenges or brings in the identity of the new or the modern Arab nationalist and the dissolution of the first generation of Arab nationalism. I think also there's, with Arab writers being in Europe and the States, there's a greater sort of a detachment about the Arab world. There's not the defensiveness that there has been in the past. A large amount of the literature of 30, 40 years ago was either what the Germans call Bildungsroman, a sort of autobiographical, or social realism, whereas now there's far more questioning of identity, of, as Samir says, exile and so on. I think it's what Samir says is true, but I think it's the volume and the extent of things in the last 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, I think there is a movement now, and I think all this sort of, you know, the new technology is helping a great deal, and therefore I don't really agree very much with Mr. Benwan Bishara about you know the Western media way of sort of misrepresenting the Arab Revolution. It is actually that the technological side of things have actually moved things forward. We could not. I mean, what we've been writing, what I've been writing to to be honest. What I've been writing for the last few years, I could have never dreamt of writing it 20 years ago, you know, because it's impossible that anybody would publish them. And then you end sort of self-censoring yourself because there's no point in writing something that's not going to be published.
Yes.
But now we can do that. So the technological side is very good. And some of these sort of cultural initiatives that, you know, Peter and others are involved in are very, very, very helpful and very encouraging. I don't want to sort of pass judgment now about what's being written for in the last 4 or 5 years. It really will take a long time before we decide whether we sort of have another renaissance within Arab literature. The new voices, actually, that I have to say, to be honest here, some of the new voices that I read is just screaming, give me the prize, which is understandable because, you know, $50,000, you know, for somebody who lives in Egypt, my God, that's a fortune.
Yes.
You know, you have to work about 20 years to earn that amount of money.
Yes.
So it's understandable that, you know, of course, as we all know from all the Booker Prizes in the world, there is an advantage and a disadvantage, and sometimes the disadvantage is more obvious than the advantage.
Well,
it takes a long time to see the advantages.
Yes. Can I comment on that?
Yes.
It is interesting that some of the writers who've been shortlisted, over succeeding years, are of an older generation, and some of them have been nominated more than once over the last 5 years. But I think if you look at the NADWA, the workshops, the stories and the writers produced for the workshop in Emerging Arab Voices, and also in the Beirut 30, Beirut 39, these are writings by writers under 40 years old, and the people who have contributed to the workshops organized by the International Prize for Arabic Fiction. There, I think you have a very distinctive voice. I think a lot of barriers are down. It's partly the influence of the diaspora. There's not the feeling of the Arab world and the rest of the world. And although a lot of new writing is based in the Arab world, it seems to me, international in flavor. And in this way, I think this is something very new, or I find very striking.
To what extent is it a limitation that the Arabic language, classical Arabic, is so uniform?
It's almost psychologically restrictive. One writer, a friend of mine, a Syrian, who writes in both English and Arabic, says that when she's writing in Arabic, she doesn't have a sense of humour.
You want a language that, you know, your family can read and understand and can enjoy it. And if they haven't been to school, or if they don't read books regularly, they wouldn't understand what you're writing, or it would be very difficult to get the message across. This is one of the most tragic things about Arab literature, that you actually write in a language that is different from the language that you communicate with your friends, with your family, with people you know. This is really very sad.
Thank you both very much. This conversation could run and run.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
The repercussions of the Arab uprising have, of course, spread around the world. From Black Africa to the Pacific, it's been quoted as an inspiration. And artists and writers in profusion have also responded. One such is the American graphic novelist Craig Thompson, whose latest work, Habibi, is a fantasy on an Islamic base, linking it to Christianity. It revels in the beauty of Arabic calligraphy and is set in a timeless Middle East that fuses exotic legend with grim modernity. When he came to meet us, Richard Lee began by asking Craig Thompson why he felt entitled to write about this subject at all.
What's a nice Midwestern boy like yourself doing writing about Islam and prostitution and castration and environmental degradation and corruption in the Middle East?
Well, one, I don't really perceive it as the Middle East. It is a fantasy fairy tale. It's not about Islam. It's more about critiquing the experience of being part of an empire, of being part of the American empire. Sort of a response, I hate to say in a post-9/11 way, but of reacting
anyway.
to Islamophobia in the States, and also this sense of our role as an imperialist and how we brought on some of our own traumas.
I think
as far as coming from a sort of like a rural, working class, fundamentalist Christian country background, I definitely think the sort of Christian circles I grew up in are the same as the sort of Muslim circles that, you know, my friends that are Muslims grew up in. Like, it's all the same sort of lifestyle and moral code and stories primarily that you grow up with. There really doesn't seem to be that big of a gap. And in fact, that whole Islamophobia surge in the States to me seemed more of like a self-loathing.
But I mean, you say it's not set in the Middle East, but I mean, there's kind of deserts, camels, and there's sultans, and
perhaps a fantasy Middle East, or I mean, all these tropes of the, you know, the desertscapes and the harems are just sort of fantastical elements I lifted from 1001 Nights. So I was thinking of that as a genre in the same way you'd think of science fiction. But in terms of reality, I was really borrowing fast and loose from all over the world. There's bits of my travels in Morocco, but there's bits of my travels in Vietnam. There's research from India and Saudi Arabia, but there's research from, you know, Europe and from America. It's really a hodgepodge. And what knits it together is my imagination and also the sort of emotional core of the relationship between the two characters, Dola and Zam. In fact, they really are just the core of the book, and everything else is just these layers of ornamentation and flavor.
Yeah, because it was a book that was a long time in coming. Where did it begin? Where was the kernel that started it off?
The kernel was those two characters, Dola and Zam. So they're two escaped child slaves, and that's all I knew about them. They emerged pretty fully realized in the second page of my sketchbook. And they were the one, you know, element that sort of comes from outside of you. That's a gift. The inspiration part of the creative process. And I felt this sort of instant parental attachment to them. I was actually researching slavery, kind of looking at slavery, through its entire historical context, including the fact that, slavery is more prominent now than ever before in the history of civilization. It just has different labels. But for some reason, I got sucked into this sort of world of East African, North African, Arab slave trade, partly because as an American, we've always known so much about our own sort of cross-Atlantic sort of Holocaust, and not known how slavery has always existed in the world, just in different contexts. And I was drawn into those same sort of fantastical landscapes that you describe of desertscapes and camel caravans. And I was reading 1001 Nights for the first time, really savoring it for all of its adventure and bawdiness and scatological humor.
Whenabouts was this?
This would have been 2004. My first creative block was in January of 2005. I had been working on a draft of the book that was quite linear. And then I just reached a dead end where I didn't know what the next page would be, what the next panel would be. I went back, reread everything I'd written, and it felt very flat and discardable. And it was around that time that I rediscovered these magic squares, this sort of mystical Sudoku that sort of shapes the book, where each square embodies a Arabic letter. And I started thinking of that as a structure for the book, and it gave me a chance to just like shatter the container of what I had, start piecing it back together in a new form, also a form that wasn't linear. So in a way, I was really being able to have a chance to tap this sort of tradition of nonlinear storytelling.
Yeah, which is straight from the Arabian Nights. I mean, it's kind of, you've got jump cuts and montage and crossfades. It's a very much more complicated narrative object now.
Yeah. It gave me a great freedom. I mean, it also gave me a structure. So that in a way, it was like imposing a cage or this grid upon the narrative. But within that grid, there was like this great freedom. Also, the theme of the book, there's so many themes around drought or blockage or castration. There's environmental drought, but there's also like the forms of drought for the characters of emotional drought, sexual drought, spiritual drought. And then for me, just thematically, I would hit these bouts of creative drought where everything dried up and I didn't know how to proceed. I mean, it was like the spell that was cast on the project because that was the primary theme.
Extraordinary. I wanted to ask, but perhaps this is not actually what was reflected, but it seems to me that there's a problem for graphic fiction in particular in dealing with subjects to do with Islamism because of the problems that Islam has with representation. Was that something that worried you at all?
Before I started the project, I had no Muslim friends in my social circle. And that's a great thing about these sort of creative projects is they really invite you to extend that circle. My Muslim friends in particular were quite open-minded and really excited for conversation. I mean, there wasn't, it's such a, I think, a misrepresentation of Islamic culture that they attack things that are different. I mean, I've felt quite the opposite.
There are kind of real-world results of this, even if there are, of course, people who are very open to creative dialogue. Is that not something that worried you at all?
I think with blankets, it had so much a sort of emotional fallout with people close to me, particularly my family, my parents, that I just didn't feel like I could do worse than that. Like, that book really offended my family at the point when it came out. With Blankets, I grew up in this very stoic Midwestern American family where you don't sit around and talk or converse. You know, there's not that sort of open discourse. But working on Blankets really invited me to reach out to my brother and sister. I have a sister who's not represented in the book, but and talk about all our shared childhood experiences and much more raw emotional things like our sexual histories, our spiritual views. I didn't talk about the book with my parents as I was working on it because I was really scared that their disapproval would close me down creatively. They took it very harshly. I mean, they referred to it as satanic, the work of the devil. I mean, I guess I got a little bit of the Salman Rushdie experience on that round.
On a kind of personal level.
Yeah. And for my dad, it was a very personal project. He was really upset about like what sort of right I had to make our private lives public. Both of them had this issue where he's like, what makes you think you're so special? What makes you think that your childhood was so traumatic? And I was like, well, that's not the point at all. Like, I don't think my childhood was particularly traumatic any more than everybody's childhood is traumatic. And that's the point in telling these stories. In telling these stories, you invite other people to share their own. And there's a dialogue, and it's not about being special. In fact, it's quite the opposite. It's about being part of something more universal.
And have you folks, have you patched that up now?
Yeah. So time has healed things. And this one surprised me a lot. They actually really enjoyed Habibi, and the first thing they said is that they were really excited to learn about the connections between Christianity and Islam.
There's also, I mean, there's a very, very strong sexual element to it. There's prostitution, you know, the girl becomes the kind of star of the Sultan's harem. Did you consider toning down the sex at all, or was that the core of the story?
It was the core of the story. That was the emotional core. That was probably the part of the story that was most personal to me, that most personally had to pursue. When I was a child, someone very close to me was raped, and I really felt like that trauma, I experienced a sort of secondhand trauma from that. Their rape was something that I knew before I even, you know, was becoming sexual myself. So it really shaped the way I grew up in that way, along with, you know, fundamentalist views and whatnot. And in the sort of standard clumsiness of growing into one's sexuality. But in that sense, I guess sexual trauma is universal. I think everybody experiences it on some level, and especially in childhood when those things are so in conflict with what it means to be a child. And some people have looked at that too as like, is this a commentary on the Islamic world? I'm like, obviously it's not. I mean, sexual abuse to children happens everywhere in the world every day. In fact, it probably is more prominent in my own country of the States. I mean, wherever there's going to be some sort of restrictions around spirituality, it tends to come out at some point in a destructive form.
I mean, there's, you know, cavorting in the gardens, also. I mean, is that a problem in particular for graphic fiction? Because, I mean, you can't describe it in some highfalutin way. You have to actually kind of show it.
It is a little bit of a problem. I didn't recognize that problem until I was on an airplane, and I had brought along some chapters that I was editing, and I was sitting squeezed between two people on an airplane, and suddenly became very, very self-aware that you can read whatever you want on an airplane. Nobody's going to know. But in graphic literature, it suddenly becomes very obvious.
There's a whole heap of research here. There's a really deep engagement. But yet it's a book that demands to be ripped through in an evening. And that's something, if you had a work of prose that was as dense as this, it would take you a week or so to read.
Well, it's a little disturbing to me when people say they read the book in 2 hours. Hopefully the whole idea behind a graphic novel is you might still consume it in the way that you've always consumed comics, but that you're going to go back and it's going to unravel new layers. There's this point in the book where Zam talks about 7 layers of heaven above and 7 layers of hell below, and in the middle, a 15th layer where all of human existence takes place. It's a battleground between those two worlds. I would think actually of their relationship, Dodola and Zam, as being that 15th layer, the sort of creamy center. And then there's several layers that you have to peel through or work your way through of heaven and hell. You know, so there's a lot of beauty, but also a lot of torture and ugliness.
Craig Thompson there talking to Richard Lee. Habibi is published by Faber, and we've got a lovely gallery on the site demonstrating how it came together from early pages to the finished work. Now we've hauled Richard back into the studio to tell us what else we've got coming up before next week's podcast.
Yes, continuing our Arab theme, Guardian Review on Saturday profiles the great Syrian poet Adonis, much tipped to be the next Arabic Nobel laureate. There's also William Dalrymple, who tells us the inside story of why Salman Rushdie was silenced at Jaipur Festival. Philip Hensher also salutes Elmer Leonard, who he argues is not only one of the best American crime writers, but one of the best American writers of the 20th century tout court. Plus, a real treat, John Banville on the complete poems of Philip Larkin.
And in next week's podcast, we'll be bringing you the voice of a writer who agreed to be locked up in a room shaped like a boat on the top of London's Festival Hall. I wonder what that's all about. But that's all from us this week. Thanks to Richard and Ian Black, Samuel El Youssef, Peter Clark and Craig Thompson. From my producer Tim Mabey and me, Claire Armistead, goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.